presentation tonight, and I hope some discussion, if I can talk really fast, will be with regard to the relationship between what I've called and what some people are calling nowadays the new physics and peace and justice issues. And Herman Deers, when he announced the talk tonight, said this was kind of a key in my series here at Holden. That's really true, because this particular presentation is an attempt for me to put together or summarize why it is that I, as a physicist, see connections between, or what connections I see between what I do in physics, or what I'm interested in physics, and my Christian conscience, which compels me into working for peace and justice in the world. And I'd like to try and make some of those connections clear for you. Not that they're necessary. There's all kinds of ways to enter into the peace and justice issues, but this is one that maybe you haven't thought about, maybe you haven't heard about before. There's a number of physicists out there. I'd say they're probably a minority amongst physicists, but there are some who interpret physics in the way I'm going to be doing it, and who see some connections in the way God works in the universe and the way God is working in society. I'm going to assume that some of you have never studied physics and don't really even know what it is. And so I'm going to start with kind of a definition of what I mean by the new physics. Maybe you don't even know what the old physics is. But physics has been said to be the study of the laws of nature, study of how the world works, how the universe is put together. Another statement about it has recently been given by Niels Bohr, who is a famous atomic physicist of the early part of the century. And he said, "I think it is wrong to think that the task of physics is to find out how nature is. Rather, physics concerns what we can say about nature." Sounds like a subtle distinction, but it's really crucial. Are the physicists talking about the way nature is? Or are they merely saying what they can say about nature? So he would say that the scientist, the physicist, is limited in what they can say by what they can say, what they can articulate, what you can express mathematically, what you can measure, what you can connect, what you can talk about, what you can establish theories about. But is that all that stuff that physicists can do, can say, is that what is? No, that's just what you can say. Lao Tzu has that famous quote that you've probably heard from back around, 500 BC or something, called, "The Tao which can be expressed is not the eternal Tao." Or the words, if you can articulate it in words, you've lost the truth. The truth that can be expressed in words is not the real, true truth. A God that can be put in the box is not my God. To talk about the new physics, instead of just physics, is to talk about physics that has basically happened since the turn of the century. It would include Einstein's theory of special relativity in the year of 1905, 1907. He came out with a couple of papers in that era. His theory of general relativity in 1915. It would include the quantum physics, which has been developed all during this century, but especially notably the big breakthrough in quantum physics came in 1928 with two major papers by Schrödinger and Heisenberg, names that might ring somebody's bells. And the atomic theory, also of this century, and elementary particle theory, also of this century, and quantum field theory, also mostly of the past 10, 15 years. Basically, a lot of exciting physics happened around the turn of the century, and we've been trying to kind of clean up the loose ends for the 50 or so years after that. There were just these radical breakthroughs. And it was formulated, those breakthroughs were formulated in a mathematical language, in a formalism, that made it rather difficult for us to deal with them conceptually. It's an esoteric language that only the physicists really understand. And you have to go through umpteen years of school and graduate school to finally get to the point where you really get a grasp of all the mathematics that deals with quantum mechanics and relativity and all that stuff. As a result, I think the general public and the physics community itself, in fact, has been very slow in kind of appreciating what the philosophical implications are of their work. A few of the physicists of that era wrote philosophically. Einstein was one, famous for his kind of reflections on his work. Niels Bohr was another, who I quoted earlier. Heisenberg wrote some pretty interesting philosophical stuff. But it's only been in the past about 10 years that, 15 years, that some of that sort of philosophical implications of what was done even back 50 years ago has been re-examined and reinterpreted. So the new physics is not merely the laws that were discovered, the rules, the equations and so forth, the theories that were set forth 50 years ago, mostly, but also an interpretation of those principles that's been worked on in the past 10 to 20 years. So what I want to talk about tonight, I guess, are some of the implications of those interpretations and the implications also of the, no. I want to talk about what are the elements of that new physics and what is the special nature of the way of interpreting that new physics that's being done now in these times. Some of the books that, and some of the authors that I'm going to be referring to, I'd like to mention now kind of all at once, so you'll have seen them and know something about them, know kind of where I'm coming from. When I was in graduate school, I was wondering about the problem that there seemed to have been so much exciting physics going on 50 years ago, and where was it today? Why was it that physics really wasn't making the radical breakthroughs, the really exciting, dynamic, revolutionary stuff in my era that it was doing back in the time of Einstein? And that came to be a social question, a question about the society of physicists, the community of physics, not just physics theory itself. But it was what I wanted to work on for a graduate thesis. It turned out I didn't get to because they said, no, that's sociology, that's history, that's not physics. You've got to do hardcore physics. So I wound up doing hardcore physics for my graduate thesis. A book that was very influential to me at that point and which has come to be a classic is Thomas Kuhn's book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, which is the Kuhn's theory in studying processes of change in science as to how science makes its discoveries, how the scientific community works to further the field of science. And there were some strange things out of that book that were not well received at the time, and in fact still in large parts of the scientific community are kind of looked down upon. But the theories of Kuhn have been very, very widely adopted as indicators of how intellectual investigations proceed. In particular, Kuhn is well known for the concept of paradigm. Paradigm being a sort of a worldview or perspective that people have, which shapes everything that they do. In fact, a more complete definition of paradigm. Let's see if I think I brought one along here. I hope. Oh, it's in here. No, it's not in here. I think I have it. Oh, good. A worldview or perception of reality, which provides a perspective for understanding, interpreting, and responding to everything that we know or experience, may include beliefs, values, assumptions, prejudices, priorities, goals, desires, stories, heroes and mythology, theories or mental models, methodologies, techniques, in fact, anything which organizes and lends meaning to the perceptions, thoughts, communications, and actions of those that adhere to the paradigm. It's a pretty comprehensive term. And Kuhn goes on to say that since your paradigm is sort of everything that goes into your worldview, your perspective, it's going to shape what you say, the way you talk, the language you use, what you choose to do, the priorities you establish. It shapes everything. And he says those operate in the scientific community, so-called objective scientific community, as well as the subjective real world. So one of Kuhn's big changes, one of his big effects on the interpretation of science was to say that basically science and physics in particular is a human enterprise. It's shaped by the culture in which it is done. It's shaped by the paradigm of those people that are doing it. Some of those paradigms are shared, and so that because when you have a shared paradigm, it enables cooperative work. If you don't have a shared paradigm, you're working at cross purposes. But when the science community establishes a shared paradigm, then they work together and further their theories. But that paradigm is culturally dependent, and that's the crucial thing that comes out of Kuhn's analysis. So what scientists see and do, and the theories they devise, depend upon their perspective, their paradigm. And therefore, science is not objective truth. This is a lot different from the way science is taught in the schools most of the time, even today. I mean, Kuhn wrote this book in 62, 23 years after Kuhn. We're still taught as kids that, you know, here's the way the world works. Here are the laws of nature. It was discovered by so-and-so that the world works this way, in this year, such and such. And it's all laid out as though this is the way the world has to be, that there's only one possible science, and that science is sort of inevitable and objective, because that's the scientific method after all. You sit in your laboratory and you look at the whole world with an open, blank slate, right? Perfectly open, wide open eyes. You see everything that is, and then you start noticing patterns in what is, and you devise a theory, and you put your theory out there, and you make predictions on the basis of your theory, you test your theory against experiment. You've probably heard that. It's the scientific method with a big T and a big S and a big N. Well, Kuhn's saying that scientific method is fine on paper, but in practice, that's not the way it works. In practice, scientists go into their laboratories and they have a lot of prejudices. They have a lot of biases. They have a lot of lenses which prohibit them from seeing everything that is. If you saw everything that is, you couldn't deal with it. So you see particular things to start with. You choose to ignore certain things and you choose to see certain things. And out of those things that you happen to see, things that you think are important enough to look at, you try to make some order. And even the process of making order means you're going to exclude more things. I mean, that's the psychologists tell us that now, too. They've got, I mean, theories of knowledge. The idea of forming ideas in your mind means excluding information. So the scientists do that. They come up with theories. And what is excluded may be very crucial. Since you are suspecting a trick, you can probably see what I wrote up there. But if you don't suspect the trick, you might not see it. And I would hope that maybe a few of you don't see that there's something strange about what I wrote up there. I hear
bird
some.
In the hand.
Yeah.
Bird in the hand.
Good. Bird in the hand. Bird in the hand. Okay. Did anybody not see it? Be honest. Let me know. Oh, good. Okay. Thanks. Yeah, just the simple-minded idea here is that if your mind has preconceived boxes to fit information into, the information is going to go into those boxes. And it'll prevent you from seeing certain things that are really there. Here there are two does, and yet you can look at that. Some people will look at it and look at it and look at it, and they'll still insist it says bird in the hand, and they'll get in a fight with you over it. And yeah, it says bird in the hand. let's try another one. It's kind of fun. If I start writing letters of the alphabet above and below a line, this is one that's fun to do with little kids. I'll put the A up here, and the B down here, the C down here, the B down here, and the E I'll put up here, and the F I'll put up here too, and the G I'll put down here, and the H I'll put up here. And the trick is, you're supposed to tell me where to put the next letter. I'll give you a hint, it goes up here. But there's a pattern developing that you may or may not see. And I'll put the next one down. Good. And next one I'll put up.
I think the others were, I put some new ones down there for you here.
Okay, where should I put the M? Up? Okay, put it up. Where should I put the N? Up? Good. Where should I put the O? Down. Okay, where should I put the P? It's nicer if it's all in one line, but I don't have space. P, Q will go down. R will go down. S?
Down.
T above. Goodness, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, T above. U below. Oh no, this is the first time we've only had one up on top. We've always had, oh no, we had the A above. It turns out that at least they tell me this, I've never tried it for sure, but that adults are supposed to have more trouble seeing this than children. That adults are looking for patterns like vowels or numbers 1, 3, 2, 1, 3, 1, 1, 3, is that pi or something, a decimal expansion of pi, or, you know, they're looking for all kinds of esoteric patterns to see what in the world, how in the world did some weirdo invent this strange arranging of the letters of the alphabet, and children will catch it right away. And for those of you who haven't caught it, it's that the letters on top are all straight line, the letters down below have curves in them.
You just one in the middle?
Pardon?
You ever put me in the middle? I didn't.
No.
Wait, we're one in the middle.
Anyway, the point of that, those are just sort of funny illustrations of how what you see is affected by what your eyes are open to, what your preconceptual boxes are arranged. Mm-hmm. There probably are other reasons. If you really... So Kuhn says, science is not objective truth. And in fact, I'm going to read a couple statements of his that were really upsetting to some of the people in the scientific community. He says, the proponents of competing paradigms are always, at least slightly, at cross purposes. Neither side will grant all of the assumptions that the other side needs to make its case. Though each may hope to convert the other to his or her way of seeing science and its problems, neither may hope to actually prove his or her case. The competition between paradigms is not the sort of battle that can be resolved by proofs. So it's kind of curious that it's because of the different worldviews that you're coming from that you don't even agree on what constitutes a proof. You don't even agree on what the problem is in the first place. And so there's a lack of communication, a lack of common meeting ground between people that are coming from different paradigms. To me, this is a metaphor, that language he's using there is very comparable to what you get in international dialogue between nations, between competing ideologies. That's what he's talking about in a way. And in fact, his theories have been applied in all kinds of other areas of social science rather than just the hard sciences. And they come out fitting remarkably well. I want to read another elaboration of that same point. But paradigm debates are not really about relative problem-solving ability, though for good reason they are usually couched in these terms. Instead, the issue is which paradigm should in the future guide research on problems, many of which neither competitor can yet claim to resolve completely. A decision between alternative ways of practicing science is called for, and in the circumstances, that decision must be based less on past achievement than on future promise. That sounds a lot like competing political theories, too. The one who embraces a new paradigm at an early stage must often do so in defiance of the evidence provided by problem solving. That person must, that is, have faith that the new paradigm will succeed with the many large problems that confront it, knowing only that the older paradigm has failed with a few. A decision of that kind can only be made on faith. Faith! Faith? What's a scientist doing talking about faith? The critique of the objectivity or rationality of science goes even deeper than that in recent years. A fellow by the name of Jones has written a book called Physics as Metaphor, and the title is very intentionally provocative. It's sort of the denial or the antithesis of saying physics as truth. For so long, we've held physics up as the hard science, the one that really leads us to objective, purely determined, rationally thought out, hardcore, undeniable, undisputable truth. He's saying, no, physics is metaphor. It's sort of, I mean, what is metaphor after all? It's kind of the fuzzy thinking that people that write literature do, right? Scientists would never be accused of building metaphors, or they would never think that that's what they were doing. And yet Jones, as a scientist, as a physicist, makes the case that, in fact, that's all we're doing, is we're building metaphors, very much like the artist or the writer is doing. The theories of physics, he says, are built on subjective notions of space and time and mass and measurement, which are creations of our mind and which are not universally held. Well, that's probably pretty well known to any anthropologists among you, that the notions of space and time are culturally dependent. Is that right? I'll look over at our Indian scholar over here. And the ideas that we have about space, about sort of that theater that we live in, and I'm over here and you're over there, and you say to your little child, you know, come here, implying there's some kind of a gulf between you and the child to be bridged. That's a very Western notion of space and not universally held. Some societies have much more of a concept of relatedness and that you're connected with other people all the time in some kind of space other than this three-dimensional space that we occupy ourselves in so much. So for them, something like telekinesis or telepathy would not be surprising at all. It's very natural because, after all, we're all in communication in this other space all the time anyway. And Jones points out a nice illustration that I'd like to read a section of with regard to the way space may have felt to people in medieval times. For example, this is not just Jones's theory, this is pretty well established by medieval scholarship with regard to the way they write, the metaphors they use, the language. To the mind of medieval people, space did not have the cold, empty, geometric character that it has for us. We experience ourselves as an isolated, disconnected entity in a vast, empty void. That's a little exaggeration, but still, there's the sense that here am I, an object, bounded by this skin, and I'm inside the skin, and in fact, I'm probably mostly up here to my neck up. The rest of me is, you know, just my body, you know. And here I am, the thing that's behind these eyes, you know. That's sort of where Western mind, okay, tends to localize itself. And yet, other peoples have a notion, first of all, much more so that the whole body is themselves, and then all the more so that body is not the extent of themselves, but they are some of their relationships with other people. They are the interconnections, not just the object. I'm getting off here. For example, to the mind of medieval people, space did not have the cold, empty geometric character it has for us. But medieval people felt more a part of their surrounding environment. They felt a kind of extrasensory but conscious connection to the plants, the animals around them, to the heavenly objects, hence astrology, to the very elements and the minerals of the earth itself. We tend to dismiss such experiences as primitive or misguided. We explain them away as examples of animism or anthropomorphism, or we reject them along with the gibberish of astrology and alchemy, which which after all have been discredited by modern science. But at the moment, we are challenging the assumptions of modern science. We are obliged to take more seriously the notions of other civilizations. The sensing of human character and life in so-called inanimate objects by many primitive and even pre-Renaissance peoples should not be viewed as some kind of magical network of relationships existing within space as we know it today. Rather, it is part of the actual experience of space for these peoples. Suppose I, as a medieval man, diagnosed myself as mercurial, and I symbolize this through a felt connection to the planet Mercury, or to the elements of quicksilver, Mercury, in the Earth's crust. Within the framework of my medieval mind, I do not picture all of this to myself as some mysterious influence of the planet Mercury acting at this large distance across the vast reaches of empty space, or as some chemical spell that quicksilver casts over my personality, regardless of its distance and separation from me in the Earth. These are not relationships in space to me. They are space. It is the sum of all of the felt organic connections between my inner and outer worlds that I experience as space itself. Space is the synthesis of all my feelings of relatedness, connectivity, orientation. As Owen Barfield says, imagine yourself a person in the Middle Ages. You are a microcosm within the macrocosm. You do not feel yourself isolated by your skin from the world outside of you. You are integrated and mortised into it, each different part of you being united to a different part of it by some invisible thread. In your relation to your environment, you are rather less like an island and rather more like an embryo than modern humanity, modern persons, modern man, he says. Jones argues that we've created our conception of space to save us from the onslaught of the notion of oneness, of connectedness, that it's very hard to deal with connectedness as experienced by children, for example, by people who have not made, in fact, we label these things as neuroses, and sometimes they are, when people cannot make the distinctions between objects, when they see things as connected, which we say, no, they aren't connected. We invent space as a way of dealing with being able to make conceptual disconnections. Space is the thing which allows us to indicate separateness. Time, similarly, he does a similar analysis for time, a similar analysis for matter, and basically comes up with the idea that, don't forget, after all, folks, that matter, time, space are creations of our consciousness, our way of thinking about things, and that there are other ways of thinking about all those concepts. Well, now, what does that say for modern physics, or the truth of science? It says that too, is built on a foundation which is culturally dependent. It's not necessary that we came up to the science that we finally have got to today. There are other sciences that we might have arrived at had we started with different cultural premises. And in fact, we can see this in other cultures, that different cultures tend toward different types of science. Yes?
Have you had any chance to work along those lines?
What kinds of other sciences would you come up with, you mean? Not very deeply, no. I play around with ideas like that, but I think if you could train young science students in recognizing alternative ways of thinking about things, there might be some more creative types of theories that they'd come up with dealing with, things in our world. But, whether I have come up with any of those, the answer is no.
Not so much that you would, but if you've been in touch with some of those, and could you share some of those?
I can give maybe one example, real quick one if I can, out of my own PhD thesis that's kind of related to this. We were working with structures of the proton. Proton is an elementary particle, the thing that makes up the nuclei of atoms, nucleus of atoms. It's the positively charged part of the nucleus. Protons were thought to be elementary particles themselves, but now it's established that they have some kind of a structure. And we were trying to come up with, what kind of a structure would a proton have? Well, maybe a proton has a structure similar to the structure of an atom. Maybe it's got little pieces going around each other. Just like the atom has the nucleus and the electrons going around it. Maybe the proton itself has a little nucleus with little electrons going around it or something. You can do it. You can write down the equations and see what kind of a force you need to hold these things together. So tight. Real strong force. What it turns out is that when you try to solve the equations, because the force is so strong, and the speeds are relativistic speeds, meaning that speeds near the speed of light, the equations don't solve as nicely as they used to solve for the atom. The equations for the atom solve quite nicely, at least in first approximation. We can get very nice descriptions of what the atoms look like and how they behave, and that behavior correlates very nicely with what we measure. But when you try and do that for the proton, it turns out that when you try to separate the equations to say, aha, it really is just two particles in interaction and here's the interactive force, it doesn't separate out cleanly. Instead, it all becomes sort of one glob. And you can do an approximate separation, but that approximation isn't even close. So you have to treat the proton as a whole. It doesn't have the quality of being separable into pieces. Even though you can write down the equation for what it would be like if it had separate pieces, you can't solve that equation as separate pieces. The pieces are in such strong, tight interaction that they cease to be recognizable as individual entities, separate pieces anymore. That's, in a sense, to me, that's kind of a metaphor that's like saying, I am not just me, this thing here, but I am the totality of my interactions with my past and with you and with the earth and all that. You can't define me without defining my relationships. Or I can't define myself without defining those relationships. Okay, that's one example. Okay, leave it there. Okay, what about modern physics? So far I've been talking about the context in which modern physics is occurring. It's occurring in a social context, a context which has dethroned it from being an absolute laws of nature to more subjective, more dependent upon the creator, the scientist. Okay. In addition, the discoveries themselves have a very similar kind of quality about them that have made nature itself seem less absolute, less rigid, less boxable. Let me talk about some of those. In special relativity, going back to that list I gave you before of what are the elements of modern physics, special relativity, we have Einstein looking at space and time and seeing that they behaved differently from the way Newton thought they behaved. Newtonian physics had lived for several hundred years, and Einstein comes along and says, look, there's some things that aren't making sense here, and he tried to put it together. And he came up with a theory that has tested out remarkably well, that suggests all kinds of screwy things. First of all, it suggests that if something is moving by you, it looks shorter. It gets shorter and shorter and shorter the faster it goes. So things get squished down in the direction of motion. At least that's how it appears. For the people on the thing going by you, they see you getting squished down because motion is relative and you can't tell one from the other. So they see you getting squished, you see them getting squished. You'd sort of think it should work the other way around. If you see them getting smaller, they should see you getting larger, but that's not the way it works. You each see each other getting squished up smaller. I see clocks on your spaceship running slower. In fact, I see your heart beating slower. I see your atoms radiating at a slower rate of speed. All your time mechanisms get slowed down from my point of view. Now, you'd expect maybe that mine should look speeded up to you, but they don't. Mine also looks slowed down to you. That's kind of strange. The time doesn't seem to have its absolute character anymore. It sort of has this relative character, both time and space, length. Simultaneity gets screwed up. You think that you can have, you know, if I'm sitting here halfway between two points, and I see a flash here and a flash here at the same time, and I know I'm halfway in between, and I know the speed of light coming this way and coming this way is the same, I think, well, that flash occurred simultaneously here and here. Well, it turns out if somebody's moving, if I'm moving at a speed near the speed of light, but I'm still halfway in between these two points, I will see one occur first and then the other. In other words, motion will change the notion of simultaneity. In fact, you can even get events reversed in time. If you're moving at the right speed and these events, these things are far enough apart, in one system, for one observer, he'll see that, and the other one will see the opposite sequence. So time can get, in effect, turned around, converted. And there's only special cases where that works. You can't make all time run backwards for a long time, but you can reverse certain pairs of events, reverse the time ordering of certain pairs of events. That was shocking. I mean, that says somehow that reality seems to depend upon who's looking at it. It got worse. With general relativity, which is the relativity that came about 10 years later, Einstein figured out how to include gravitation in his theories of relativity and acceleration. And so general relativity predicts things like black holes that we've been hearing about lately, and it looks as though the astronomers are finding these things out in the far reaches, that there may really be black holes. And a black hole is, at least the simplest ones, are collapsed stars, where a star, when it loses its fissionable material that keeps the energy going and radiating outward, which keeps the star expanded, like our sun, when it loses all that and no longer has anything to push it outward, then gravity pulls it inward. And it can, for some stars that are sufficiently massive, it can pull it and pull it and pull it and pull it inward to the point where it becomes so incredibly massive that nothing can escape from it. If you try and throw a little pebble up from it, that will drop back down. If you try and shoot a rocket up from it, that'll fall back down. And in fact, if you shine a flashlight out from it, the light will come back down. You can't even get light out from these black holes. Well, turns out, this is all according to theory, but like I say, they're finding things that seem to behave according to this theory as well. Turns out that around the black hole, there's a thing called an event horizon. And the event horizon is sort of a point of no return, in effect. If you were falling into the black hole, or had a rocket, and you were trying to explore this thing, as long as you stayed outside the event horizon, you could always, if you had enough fuel in your rocket, you could always get away from the thing. Okay. No matter how much fuel you expend, you're always going to wind up crashing into the center of the black hole. Sort of, it's that kind of point of no return. Okay. And likewise, if you're standing outside that event horizon, you can still communicate with the outside world. If you're inside that event horizon, you can't get any messages out anymore because your light signals or radio signals or whatever way you're trying to get stuff out always gets sucked back in. Okay. Well, it turns out that the funny thing happens as you make a mental model of someone taking a rocket ship or falling themselves into a black hole, and they start trying to communicate with you. As they're falling into that black hole, their time goes slower and slower and slower and slower from your point of view back on Earth. So. And you see their radio frequencies that they're sending back to you, let's say, get elongated, the wavelengths get elongated, the frequencies get lower, slower. Their voices start dropping down lower and lower, and the radio signals get less. All their light frequencies that you see from them get redshifted, first toward the red end of the spectrum, and then pretty soon you can't even see them in the visible part of the spectrum anymore. They turn into infrared, and pretty soon all the visible light is in the ultraviolet range. And the radio waves that they were sending you, instead of being 1 meter waves, become 1,000 meter waves. And finally, as you're watching their little heartbeats, or hearing the heart monitoring of their heartbeat, the little thumps that used to be coming 60 times a minute, pretty soon they're coming 10 times a minute, pretty soon they're coming once a minute, and pretty soon every year you say, hey, we got a heartbeat from the folks falling into the black hole. Okay? Their time slows down and slows down and slows down. And so from our point of view on Earth, they never actually pass through that event horizon, because at that event horizon, their time actually stops. So what we see is everything that's ever fallen into the black hole piled up on the event horizon. Wash machines and bathtubs and clocks and scientists and rocket ships and everything is all piled up there, but we can't see it anyway because it's radiating light back to us at basically zero frequency. With, you know, the light, everything gets so slowed down that it goes there and it gets slower and slower and slower and never makes it. So like Zeno's paradox, you know, the tortoise can never overtake the hare or something because he has to go halfway first, and they get halfway, he has to go halfway there and has to go half. You've heard that? No, never mind. If you haven't heard it, it doesn't. Okay, so what we'd say happened in that situation is, and we saw it happen, and we can go there and explore with our rocket as long as we stay outside the event horizon. We can go and check it out and see, sure enough, there they are, just about able to go through, but they've stopped. We say the reality of that situation to us is that they have stopped falling into the hole, and they're sitting there on the event horizon in a state of suspended animation. What happens from their point of view? From their point of view, they just fall right on through that old event horizon as though it's not there. Their hearts are beating. Everything's going just fine. If they're looking back at Earth, what they see is things speeding up, going faster and faster back on Earth. They see generation after generation being born and dying, radio signals coming like crazy. And they pass on through that event horizon without anything noticeably happening to them. Now, once they're through, they're never going to be able to talk to people back on Earth again, but they have their own lifetime, their own world inside that black hole that's removed from ours. So you say, what's real? I mean, which is the real reality? Do they really get through or don't they? Well, it seems like you can invent a reference frame in which they really do get through, but from the perspective of us back on Earth, they never do get through. So again, it's that point of how are you looking at it? Whose perspective are you using? Which reality do you see? Oh, brother. How to make this a two-part talk. I wanted to save some time for comments because it's just, this is heavy stuff sometimes, and I know it's kind of weird, but. I think I'll summarize it really quickly and read a couple things, try and... And maybe some other time I'll talk about it a little bit more. I'm just getting the exciting part, which is quantum mechanics. I mean, if you think relativity is weird, quantum mechanics is even more weird. I was going to try and do kind of a little experiment up here for you, a thought experiment, but I won't do that. I'll instead read to you some of the generalizations that one concludes about the way quantum mechanics is weird. People like Fritjof Capra have written about quantum mechanics in this book called The Tao of Physics, also in The Turning Point, where he deals more with the implications, the social implications of seeing the world from a physicist's point of view. And I'm just going to read a couple selections of Capra's, give you a flavor of the different way in which you see things when you see things as a quantum mechanicist, quantum mechanic. A careful analysis of the process of observation in atomic physics shows that the subatomic particles have no meaning as isolated entities, but can be understood only as interconnections or correlations between various processes of observation and measurement. As Niels Bohr wrote, isolated material particles are abstractions, their properties being definable and observable only through their interactions with other systems. Sounds like I said before, doesn't it? Subatomic particles, then, are not things, but are interconnections between things. And these things, in turn, are interconnections between other things, things in quotes, and so on. In quantum theory, you never end up with things. You always deal with interconnections. This is how modern physics reveals the basic oneness of the universe. It shows that we cannot decompose the world into independently existing smallest units, As we penetrate into matter, nature does not show us any isolated building blocks, but rather appears as a complicated web of relations between the various parts of a unified whole. As Heisenberg, one of the fathers of quantum mechanics, expresses it, the world thus appears as a complicated tissue of events in which connections of different kinds alternate or overlap or confine and thereby determine the texture of the whole. The universe, then, is a unified whole that can, to some extent, be divided into separate parts, into objects made up of molecules and atoms and themselves made up of particles. But here, at the level of particles, the notion of separate parts breaks down. The subatomic particles, and therefore ultimately all parts of the universe, cannot be understood as isolated entities, but must be defined through their interrelations. Henry Staff of the University of California writes, "An elementary particle is not an independently existing, unanalyzable entity. It is, in essence, a set of relationships that reach outward to other things." This shift from objects to relationships has far-reaching implications for science as a whole. Gregory Bateson has even argued that relationships should be used as the basis for all definitions, and that this should be taught to our children in elementary school. Anything, he believed, should be defined not by what it is in itself, but by its relation to other things. The crucial feature of quantum theory is that the observer is not only necessary to observe the properties of an atomic phenomenon, but is even necessary to bring about these properties. My conscious decision about how to observe, say, an electron, will determine the electron's properties to some extent. If I ask it a question that merits a particle answer, it will give me a particle answer. It will behave as a particle. If I ask it a question that dealing with its wave properties, it will give me a wave answer. In other words, the electron does not have objective properties independently of my mind. That's a strong statement. The electron, as the archetype of elementary particles, does not have independent properties, or does not have objective properties independently from the questions that I ask of it, from its interaction with me. In atomic physics, the sharp Cartesian division between mind and matter, between observer and observed, can no longer be maintained. We cannot speak about nature without at the same time speaking about ourselves, because we are the ones asking the questions. We are the ones making the measurements. In transcending the Cartesian division between mind and matter, Cartesian refers to Descartes, the philosopher that made this very sharp distinction between what we think and all the material stuff. In transcending this Cartesian division, modern physics has not only invalidated the classical ideal of an objective description of nature, but has also challenged the myth of a value-free science. The patterns scientists observe in nature are intimately connected with the patterns of their minds, with their thoughts, and with their values. Thus, the scientific results they obtain and the technological applications they investigate will be conditioned by their frame of mind. Although much of their detailed research will not depend explicitly on their value system, the larger paradigm within which this research is pursued will never be value-free. Scientists, therefore, are responsible for their research, not only intellectually, but morally. Okay, that's too soon. This holistic way of thinking, this idea of interconnections, of participation with everything, I think, and a lot of other people think, like Capra, has a lot to say with, implies a sort of ethic, implies a connectedness with people, a connectedness with the earth, that is essentially, at its essence, at its root, an ecological ethic and an ethic of caring, an ethic of recognizing our interdependency, recognizing the foolishness of war, in which any harm you do to your enemy is harm to yourself. It's Jesus' ethic of, you know, love your enemy, or love your neighbor as yourself, because your neighbor is yourself in some sense. There's this relatedness that is at the core of everything. And rather than come up with prescriptions about what we should do to solve the peace problem, or the justice problem, or the rich-poor problem, I'd like to see more of a transformation in the way people look at those problems so that they look at them holistically, they look at the systemic interactions, they understand the interdependencies, somewhat in, as is done through the eyes of a modern physicist. That's it. Time's up.